estate pension by then. But your campaign, Lawrence, looking for growth, has been trying to encourage politicians to adopt a more pro-growth mindset, saying we need to build the houses, build the railways. How much traction have you been getting amongst MPs, and is there a particular side that's listening? Is Labour listening to what you're trying to say?
What's frustrating is both the fact that it's very good to see we've had quite a big impact, MPs are on side, but when it comes to actually enacting change, announcements are very good, but actually seeing it through every single day, this is what we keep seeing failing. We keep seeing failing. It's not just from really MPs are attempting something, but the system itself is resisting in great detail. And unfortunately as well, with announcements like this, there is no clear strategy. They are not trying to re-electrify rail that we need to be re-electrified. They're not clear. One minute we're cancelling HS2, the next we're doing little parts of it again. They're talking about spending caps, but no real plans about how the spending caps are actually going to be applied. The whole thing is, to be quite honest with you, a disaster, and originates from not willing to get to grips with the actual problem and radically solve it by changing the planning system itself. And not also passing radical change necessary to get this built and get it built under budget.
I agree absolutely entirely, and hopefully it will be built into a railway I can ride one day. That was Lawrence Newport, and thank you very much for your company this afternoon. My producer was Lizzie Highfield, and Ryan Boydett was pressing the buttons. Jane and Fee are up next here on Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, 2 o'clock. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover with you here on Times Radio until four.
And coming up in the next 2 hours, Kemi Badenoch welcomed the government's latest U-turn at today's PMQs. We'll be joined by Lucia Hodson, Boris Johnson's former advisor. We're going to find out what the latest developments in Iran mean for the women of the country, with Iranian-British activist Nagin Shirogayan. And should our pets be vegan? We're going to explore the world of plant-based pets with environmental campaigner Chris Packham. And after 3:30, our big guest is darling, Sir Derek Jacobi.
Looking forward to that. He's such a great actor. Let's start with the news at 2. Here's Tom Noonan.
Good afternoon, Jane. Thank you. The Times has been told the Chief Constable of West Midlands Police will refuse to resign, even if the Home Secretary declares she has no confidence in him. Shabana Mahmood is speaking to MPs after Craig Guildford apologised again for giving them incorrect evidence. He's revealed some of the evidence used to justify a ban on Israeli football fans last year was actually generated by AI. Former FA chairman David Bernstein has told Times Radio ministers should act faster.
I don't think the government's heart is really in this subject. It's got all sorts of associated issues. It worries about its voting base and so on. And although it sort of talks the talk, I don't believe its heart is really in dealing with this issue. So they prevaricate, they go as slowly as they can. Now it's come to a stage where they may have to do something. But I think it's very late, very, very late in the day.
Elon Musk says his Grok AI model will not produce any illegal images and will comply with the laws of any country. The owner of X says he's not aware of any child sexual abuse images being produced with the tool, something the regulator Ofcom is investigating. The Prime Minister says he's been given assurances the site will comply with British law. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, has accused Sir Keir Starmer of not knowing his own policies after he U-turned on digital IDs. It's thought to be Labour's 13th major U-turn since the election. Sir Keir Starmer says they will now be optional, not compulsory, in order to work in the UK, but he insists other measures will be in place instead.
Mr. Speaker, I'm determined to make it harder for people to work illegally in this country, and that's why there will be checks, they will be digital, and they will be mandatory.
Reuters is reporting a US official who says American personnel are being withdrawn from major bases in the Middle East after threats from Iran. Tehran says it will strike US bases, including in Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Turkey, if Donald Trump orders military action in response to the killing of protesters. A 26-year-old man is due to be executed, and his family has been told. The Conservative Shadow Foreign Secretary, Dame Priti Patel, has told Times Radio the UK needs to be more involved.
And I was calling on the government yesterday to do much more. I was calling on the government 2 weeks ago. Go to speak out. There was no indication in the government statement yesterday that they're undertaking any of this other than summoning the ambassador and looking at more sanctions. And I'm urging the government to really work with America, work with those that can make a difference.
Donald Trump says NATO should be helping the US take control of Greenland. Danish, Greenlandic and American officials are meeting in Washington. Ukraine's former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko has been charged over an alleged bribery scheme. Ms. Tymoshenko was one of the leaders of the pro-democracy Orange Revolution in 2004. She says it's a purge designed to stop her being a rival to President Zelensky. And the family behind Russell and Bromley are thought to be split over whether to sell the company to Next or to a private equity firm. Auralis has proposed a deal which would save all the footwear brand's jobs, its head office and distribution centre, and most of its shops. The proposal by Next, meanwhile, is expected to close all of the stores and put most of the jobs at risk. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Well, welcome to Wednesday afternoon here on Times Radio. It is Jane and Fee with you until 4 o'clock. It's 4 minutes past two at the moment. Shabana Mahmood is live in the House of Commons making a statement to do with the findings of the report into the police handling of the Maccabi Tel Aviv game. And we will join that if we need to, or we will bring you details from what she said just as soon as she has finished talking. Elsewhere in PMQs, the Kama Sutra got a mention. It all went a bit end of term sing-along with a chant of U-turn, 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 and we'll head there in just a couple of moments' time to start the show with a review of PMQs. Are you vegan? Is it working for you? Do you love animals so much you don't want to eat them? You have them as pets, but the pets are eating animal stuff at their mealtime, and that doesn't sit very well with you. Well, all of that has happened to the environmental campaigner Chris Packham and his two poodles who are called, and I'm going to say Nancy and Sid, because I feel uncomfortable saying Sid and Nancy about two poodles who are presumably rather lovely creatures. He's going to come on and tell us why he's embraced veganuary for his pets. You might have thoughts about that one. It's 0333 003 2353 if you do. As Iran teeters on the brink, we ask about the women in the country who've been campaigning for so long against the strict regime of the Islamic Republic. Women killed for not adhering to the laws of men, just some men, where in the current protests, they have certainly been picked out, and they have been obviously punished in the past for simply refusing to wear the hijab, for refusing to stay indoors, for refusing to do all of the things that we regard as a perfectly reasonable freedom for women in the West. So we're going to talk about that. Elsewhere, heated rivalry is setting pulses racing. Now, this is a drama series. It's on Now Television. Yeah. I think it
is. Not on my Now.
Anyway. Not on Jane's Now. We've had a lot of discussions about Jane's Now TV membership in the production office. I don't think we'll bring those to the public party, if that's okay. But we are going to talk about this series because it has really rocked people who've watched it in a very good way, but not for the ice hockey scenes. Scott Bryan, our TV correspondent, is going to talk about the most explicit gay sex scenes ever seen on British TV. Now, our direction of travel as a society seems to be towards more explicit things. And Chris Stokel-Walker will talk about grok and nudification in our tech news. And also a point in time where YouTube has taken over from the BBC in terms of short form viewings. End of day stuff, kids. And after 3:30, what might happen?
Great big guest today. It is the leading actor. He's such a great actor. Sir Derek Jacobi joins us after 3:30. But we'll go to the Commons and the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, on her feet. She's talking about the findings of a report on the Maccabi Tel Aviv fan ban.
Faced by a game of such importance, the Chief Constable of the Force, Craig Guildford, should have ensured more professional and thorough work was done. As Sir Andy himself says, the shortcomings detailed in his report are, and I quote, symptomatic of a force not applying the necessary strategic oversight and not paying enough attention to important matters of detail, including at the most senior levels. The ultimate responsibility for the force's failure to discharge its duties on a matter of such national importance rests with the Chief Constable. And it is for that reason that I must declare today that the Chief Constable of West Midlands Police no longer has my confidence. It has been, as I understand it, over 20 years since a Home Secretary last made such a statement. But on the evidence provided by Sir Andy Cook, the Chief Inspector of Policing, that is now the case. Until 2011, the Home Secretary had the authority to dismiss a Chief Constable, a power that was removed by the last Conservative government. Today, it is only Police and Crime Commissioners who hold this power. And so the Chief Constable's future rests with the local Police and Crime Commissioner and not with me. But I am sure that Simon Foster will now follow all due process as he considers that question for himself. I do, however, believe this illustrates that Home Secretaries should, in future, have this power restored to them. When a Chief Constable is responsible for a damaging failure of leadership, the public rightly expect the Home Secretary to act. And I intend to restore their ability to do so. I can announce today that this government will soon reintroduce the Home Secretary's power to dismiss chief constables in light of significant or persistent failings, and that this will be part of the government's upcoming white paper on wider police reform, with legislation to follow. I do not expect this power to be used often, but I think it must be available at those rare moments when it is warranted. Madam Deputy Speaker, Sir Andy Cook's report is devastating. It catalogues failures that did not just affect the travelling fans, they let down our entire Jewish community in the West Midlands and across the country. I speak today not just as Home Secretary, but also as a Member of Parliament for a Birmingham constituency. In his report, Sir Andy says he believes the police acted in an attempt to avoid long-term damage to local community relations. If that is the case, what a grossly misguided effort it was. Peaceful, harmonious communities rely on a police service that, above all else, pursues the truth. In a world in which misinformation flows freely and dangerously, the police, in this case, added further misinformation into our public debate, when they could and should have provided the truth that could have allayed fears. In doing so, West Midlands Police did not support community relations. Instead, they inadvertently made things worse. This must serve as a lesson to police forces across the country, a reminder that they are called to their profession to serve truth and the law, to police our streets without fear or favour, and that community trust and cohesion depends upon them doing that above all else. And with that, Madam Deputy Speaker, I commend this statement to the House.
Shabana Mahmood, she is the Home Secretary, of course, talking there about Craig Guildford, Chief Constable of West Midlands Police Force. The Home Secretary has lost confidence in that gentleman. You have to imagine he won't be very long in the job. Let's go back to the Commons and discuss PMQs. But actually, before we do that, we will ask our guest today, Lucia Hodgson, former Downing Street Special Advisor to Boris Johnson, now a partner at Charles Buy Strategy, what she makes of what the Home Secretary has just said. What do you think?
Well, I think it's very interesting hearing the plan to potentially bring in powers to be able to make a quicker decision on this in future. And I think that the fact we're still talking about the Maccabee Tel Aviv incident, I think a lot of people will be wondering how this wasn't resolved sooner and why this, you know, feet were dragged over this. So I think I'm sure Shabana Mahmood will be wondering why she's still talking about it. But it sounds like she's made quite an interesting intervention there with potential knock-on effect for future incidents.
Yeah, so what will happen in the short term then? Presumably he will have to quit, won't he?
It sounds like
or he's
it.
Been but fired.
Well, it sounds like one of the two things yeah. are about to happen. But I think, again, the fact that he hasn't decided to step down, until potentially today, when it sounds like people have known that there was other information or that the wrong information was sought, it all sounds a bit of a muddle, to be honest. And the fact that he's probably kind of kept his role knowing that this stuff was going to come out doesn't particularly bode well for him, I don't think.
No, OK, and I think that's possibly an understatement. let's discuss PMQs then from earlier today. Now, it was dominated by the government's many U-turns. Both Sir Keir Starmer and Kemi Badenoch, we should say, have condemned the Iranian crackdown on protesters. They both did that. Then they turned inevitably to domestic matters. And the Tory leader, Ms Badenoch, began by mocking the dropping of mandatory digital ID.
Mr Speaker, can I welcome the Prime Minister's latest U-turn? I feel like I say that every week. Mandatory digital ID was a rubbish policy, and we on this side of the House are glad to see the back of it. Yeah. But yesterday, the health secretary said the Prime Minister's New Year's resolution should be, and I quote, to try to get it right first.
Kemi Badenoch. She did mock the latest U-turn on digital ID, of course, and this was the PM's rather blue response. Here we go.
Whether on planning, child poverty, employment rights, investing in our NHS, we're taking the right choices for Britain, and they oppose every single one of them. And she talks about U-turns and consistency. From the party that used to recognise the challenge of climate change, and now they run from it. Who promised to cut immigration, but then lost control of it. Who once took great pride in our diversity. Now they talk of deporting our neighbours to achieve cultural coherence. And Mr Speaker, on consistency, don't get me started on 5 Prime Ministers, 6 Chancellors, 8 Home Secretaries, 16 Housing Ministers. They had more positions in 14 years than the Kama Sutra. No wonder they're knackered and they left the country screwed.
Kevin Baird-Nott.
Goodness me, I mean, Viagra's coursing through the House of Commons. Is it just me or has PMQs just got better? What do you think?
I agree. I thought today's was actually quite entertaining and there was a whole host of things that they could have gone on. I actually didn't catch the end of what Keir said in the office because everyone was shouting and outraged so much by the initial Kama Sutra comment, which I don't know about you, but is a word I didn't really want to associate the Prime Minister with.
I think we can all get... You can sort of always tell when something's been pre-planned and that obviously that had, hasn't
it? Oh, definitely. I'm certain of it.
He'd been practising that.
Yeah, exactly. But I do wonder whether his
is also a drink.
Yeah, I don't want to think about that either. But I do think that his Kama Sutra comment and Wes's get things right first were possibly two good examples of... thoughts that could have stayed inside heads rather than committed to the record, and both made for quite a entertaining PMQs today.
Now, I think it's been so widely acknowledged over the last, I don't know, couple of months that Kemi Badenoch's getting a lot better. But people were saying, well, it wasn't having much impact on the polling. It has just sort of started to, hasn't it?
I also think consistency is quite important. I definitely, watching it today, thought that she seemed quite happy and relaxed.
She's confident.
Yeah, and I think taking it in her stride, and I do think that if you do that for the next 3 years consistently, and those kind of, you know, murmurings around her quality or performance fade away, then I think that's what has an impact. But I think if you ask, you know, the public what they think about her or her policies, you will probably find that people don't have much of an opinion formed on it. So that consistency is probably quite key for her in the coming years.
But this is an opportunity for her, and it's one that Nigel Farage doesn't get, of course.
Which he famously is very upset about.
And you sort of can understand why he might be, bearing in mind that she appears to be reaping the benefits.
Yeah, it's a good shop front. And today's a really good example of picking the right topic, repeating the words of Wes back to him, which made for, I think, quite an awkward moment on the front bench. Although I was also thinking that it is turning into a bit of a back and forth on whose track record can we most denigrate. And I definitely think Keir needs to move away from that. I mean, he doesn't particularly answer the question. And when he does, he reels off kind of the number of Tory failures. And I think to myself, that was probably fine in election campaigning season. But actually, him having some responses ready on what his policy is to come back to Kemi's criticisms would be much more interesting and I think effective. And instead, he points to kind of the defections, which, of course, is worth mentioning. But he doesn't defend his record or his ideas, which I suppose then I guess is the problem, is what are his ideas? And, you know, unlucky number 13 today with the U-turn. How is he going to get on the front foot and actually explain to people what he wants to do on illegal migration if it's now not digital ID?
Can we just be brought down to earth by a listener who says, here's a shocking thought, it's Matt in Nottingham, PMQ shouldn't be about entertainment but about holding power to account. He's right, actually, isn't he? So I hate myself for being entertained by it.
Yes, but also I think you can do both effectively, and I do think that there's a place for it to be witty, biting, entertaining, as well as the bit that I think is lacking, which is exactly the point that the listener makes, which is why isn't Keir coming back to Kemi with either a defence of his position or saying why he doesn't want to scrap business rates, which is the Conservative policy. He needs a position on why he doesn't agree that the Conservatives' idea is the right one.
So maybe the Labour smart boys who come up with all the big jokes, they should be working on
that. Move away
from
Kama Sutra, maybe, yeah, and think about what their ideas are to trump Kemi's.
This is how Kemi Badenoch wrapped up her questions, and I'm not sure really what I think about these audience participation moves, but anyway, let's have a listen.
He says no one's going to listen to us. Who's going to listen to him? The winter fuel allowance, U-turn. Waspy women, U-turn. The two-child benefit cap, U-turn. Grooming gangs inquiry, U-turn. The family farms tax, U-turn. Digital ID, U-turn. Jury trials,
U-turn.
We hope so, we hope so. I think that's going to be the next one, Mr. Speaker. Week after week, these poor people sitting behind him have to defend the indefensible, only for him to U-turn a few days later. Mr. Speaker, one of his cabinet ministers told a journalist that what's happening at the moment is extraordinarily bad. Another said, we've gone through a catastrophic series of missteps. Yet another minister said, we are so unpopular at the moment, I've come to the conclusion it's worth rolling the dice on a new leader. They're right, aren't they?
Mr. Speaker, here's the difference. I changed my party, and that's why we stand here with a majority Labour government.
OK, was that any good?
It's a bit panto. But I do think if you're sat in CCHQ thinking about what you want to do with this week's, the U-turn is obviously a gift. And so I think, you know, the sort of call and response is, I guess. But also she's bringing her backbenchers with her. And I think much to your earlier comment on the improvements, I think you can tell the mood of the Conservative benches is better, and it is a little bit cheesy, but I can see why they've gone for it.
Quick word on Rachel Reeves, who at this very moment is talking about rail upgrades in the north of England. Those of us who have spent time in the north of England, I mean, come on, when is this actually going to happen?
I think that's a great question.
It's just
there's
phenomenal.
A lot lacking in today's announcement.
Well, it's another, it's a re-announcement.
It's a re-announcement. Yes. I mean, this term has been baffling us. Re-announcement is just such government speak.
Yeah,
isn't
and
it?
I also worry that if you go back to sort of the HS2 playbook, it does feel like it wouldn't be a surprise if in 2 years' time they stand up, hopefully not like Rishi in the north of England, and say that they've decided to chop half of the line. But you do just think
it'll be re-cancelled.
Yes, exactly. It doesn't bode well.
No, really great to have you on the programme. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Lucia Hodgson, former Downing Street Special Advisor to Boris Johnson, and she now works at Charles Buy Strategy.
So just a quick recap on what the Home Secretary told us a couple of moments ago. Home Secretaries are going to be given new powers to sack chief constables who fail their communities. And she is declaring that the Chief Constable of West Midlands Police no longer has her confidence. Right, we're going to go to something completely different, as we like to do in the afternoons. We're going to talk about vegan dogs. Do you want one? Do you need one? If you're meat-free, is it fair to make your pets follow suit? The legend that is Chris Packham is going to be up next. You're currently listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Explore all the sale offers at wickes.co.uk or visit your local Wickes store.
Early breakfast with Rosie Wright on Times Radio. Start the morning bright and early with me, Rosie Wright, to discover the day. I have a first look at the news.
We've got far more patients needing help and far fewer GPs to deliver it.
The business headlines.
We've seen signs that we could actually avoid a recession.
Sports and, of course, politics too.
The government really coming under criticism, particularly from the House of Lords, that they didn't put a much more binding agreement in place.
Early breakfast with Rosie Wright.
Tomorrow morning from 5 on Times Radio. Radio.
I always enjoy going back to my childhood home to see Mum and Dad, but as they get older, the more and more guilty I would feel, you know, about leaving them on their own, especially in winter when it's so cold and miserable outside. I visit as often as I can with the rest of my family, but Mum and Dad really need someone around who can help them more regularly than we can. So thank goodness for Ellie. She's their care professional from Home Instead, and she actually lives with Mum and Dad, which means she can be there for them whenever they need her. It gives us real peace of mind. Mum and Dad really don't want to leave their home, and we don't want them to either. So living care from home instead was the perfect solution for us. It's been amazing. And Ellie's made such a difference to their lives too. They are so much happier, so much better in themselves. So now, whenever I visit them, they don't feel like Mum and Dad who need to be looked after. They feel like my parents again.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Feel that? That little buzz of excitement? That's the weekly flutter. With chances to win up to £10,000, enter British Heart Foundation's lottery for a thrill with goodwill behind it. Because when you play, it helps fund life-saving research. So go on, keep playing, keep winning, keep us beating. Search BHF Lottery. Gamble responsibly. Over 18s only. T's and C's apply. Please see our website for more details. British Heart Foundation is a registered charity.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Let Wix install your new kitchen. Choose from a wide range of kitchens and add the option of installation to your order. For complete peace of mind, all installations include a 2-year workmanship guarantee. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Let me bring you the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. In at number 3, British couple killed in scuba diving accident in the Maldives. The very sad story of Elaine Richmond and her husband Malcolm. They were very experienced divers and had made more than 60 visits to the resort where they died. The second most read story, police chief digging in after misleading MPs over the Maccabee Tel Aviv ban. Well, that story has changed in the last couple of moments. It is about Craig Guildford. He has admitted that police intelligence was generated by AI. And once again, the hard left is wrong on Iran. That is the most read piece on the Times website. It's Danny Finkelstein's column for the paper. He says Jeremy Corbyn and his allies regard the Iranian regime as a bulwark against capitalist imperialism, very much like the Soviet Union. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You do need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. You can go to thetimes.com/subscribe. So we are going to talk about veganism for your pets. The environmental campaigner Chris Packham has got a dirty secret. Despite going vegan in Veganuary in 2018, his pet poodles, Nancy and Sid, have been chowing down on a raw meat diet, something that he knows has a damaging impact on the planet. But no more, because this month, Chris has embarked on a 90-day transition to move his beloved dogs onto a nutritionally complete plant-based diet, documenting the impact on their health and happiness. Chris joins us now. Chris, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I suppose, in a sense, what took you so long to make this decision? Because you are a confirmed vegan yourself.
Yes, that's right. And I think there were a combination of factors there. The previous two dogs that I had, Itchy and Scratchy, I transitioned away from what you might call a normal dog food diet and onto a raw meat diet. And I saw a significant improvement in their health there. And I suppose that was 20 years ago, though. And I suppose what happened was there was a sufficient accumulation of new science, which, you know, undoubtedly presented an opportunity to do take the next step, which was to, you know, guarantee their health. But by transferring them away from the raw meat diet and onto this plant-based diet. And in that interim period of 20 years, as I say, significant peer-reviewed science has come to the fore, which has suggested that it's, in fact, more healthy for dogs to be on a plant-based diet than it is that raw meat or other diet. So it was timing, and it is a dirty secret, because obviously the three principal reasons that I switched to a plant-based diet myself, my own health, then the health of the planet. We know that the meat and dairy industry has an enormous impact on you know, generating emissions, which are impacting climate breakdown. And obviously the single largest driver of biodiversity loss. And given we've lost 70% of the world's wildlife since 1970, that's obviously of grave concern to people like myself. And then lastly, it would be farmed animal welfare, because obviously, whilst we may be able to, you know, focus our interest if we want to continue to eat meat on finding high welfare meat for in the human food chain, it's a lot more difficult to do that in the pet food chain. And as a consequence of that, I you know, kept them on that diet for longer than I really should have done. I think that the data was there last summer, but Veganuary is a good time to make the switch, and we've started it. And I've got to say, before we go on, they love it. Now, Nancy, miniature poodle, famed for being picky over their food, you know, typically when I put the food down, she circles around the bowl, she has a little sniff, and then she moves in, nibbles, and if we're lucky, she'll eat the whole meal. With the plant-based stuff, and I'm not just saying this, I'm going to film it and put it online, she literally races to the bowl and gobbles the food down. So that's a massive relief for us when it comes to getting her to eat in the first place.
Would there be flavourings and enhancers in the plant-based food that are simply telling Nancy and Sid, and we'd love to hear about Sid's reaction too, that they are eating meat? You know, can you kind of confuse your dogs into thinking they're getting meat?
That's not the mission. The company that produce it, Omni, are founded by a vet, and the formulation for this diet is very much a lab-based affair. It's a diet which is underpinned by by research and science. And what they have successfully done is found different sources, plant-based sources, for all of the required nutrients that the dogs need. So all of the fatty acids, the proteins, the amino acids, the vitamins, the minerals, they have sourced from various plant sources, pulses, algae, things like broccoli, squash, butternut squash, and carrots are also in there as well. But, you know, the key thing is, it's when in terms of the dog's, you know, nutritional welfare, it's making sure it's got the right components. It's not about where they come from. And now that an alternative is available to those meat-based sources of those essential nutrients, then it's something that obviously I was keen to try, and plenty of other people are trying it too.
I've got a very large greyhound, Chris, also called Nancy. Greyhounds are notoriously windy, and do you know what? I would genuinely be fearful of putting her on an all plant-based diet because of the implications it might have for my entire family, quite possibly my neighbours.
That windy. Oh, dear. Well, look, the one thing we have to say as well is that taste is really important. That's why I'm so pleased that Nancy has taken to it. From my point of view, another factor involved in making this decision was, will they enjoy it? Because food is a massive part of a dog's life. And of course, individual dogs might have various health concerns, and therefore we would always encourage people to visit their vets if they were thinking about changing their diets and see what the impact might be. There might be that they can do it, but they might require supplements. So again, professional advice would be welcome. But I mean, look, the key thing is, just give it a go. See firstly whether your Nancy likes the food, and then check out what happens, you know, when it comes to the what can only be described as a flatulence that's impacting negatively on the World Health Authority.
I think the methane would be a contributing factor to climate change. Is the Omni stuff very expensive, Chris? Because actually what's happened in the human world is that an awful lot of plant-based food can come in at a whopping price. You do wonder what's in it, or wonder whether you're being taken for an almighty ride.
I think there's a balance here. I mean, it is Omni expensive. I think that overall it's going to save me money on the raw meat diet. And one of the reasons for that is wastage with the raw meat, because you're dealing with raw meat. So when you defrost it, you can't refreeze it. And if the dogs don't eat it, or you miss a mealtime, you're late back, or whatever it happens to be, then unfortunately, in my case, that goes to the wild animals over the fence. But in many people's cases, then that meat would be wasted. And I got very frustrated with the amount of money that I was spending on their diet that they weren't actually consuming, but the lucky badgers and foxes around the corner were having. So I think that there will definitely be a saving there. The other issue is human health, because when you're handling raw meat, you've got to be very conscious of the fact that it comes from that food chain where botulism and salmonella and other diseases are prevalent. I'm not saying that you can't deal with that, but you've got to be conscious of it the whole time. So you've got to make sure that everything is properly sterilized and washed cleanly every day, and you wash your hands and so on and so forth, or you wear gloves to handle the meat. And then obviously those bacteria can get passed on to your dogs, and they can cross-infect. Yeah. So, you know, I'm not portraying the raw meat diet as something which is, you know, essentially dangerous, but it's something that needs to be managed to make sure that it isn't. So handling a plant-based diet and keeping it in the house, storage, so on and so forth, is a lot easier. In terms of answering your question empirically, I'm going to give it 90 days. I know how much I was spending, and I'm going to know how much I have spent. And I do you know what? If they don't balance out or Omni doesn't come out slightly cheaper, I'll be surprised, principally on account of wastage.
Well, maybe we can persuade you to come back on in 90 days and we will have another full debrief as to how this project veganism has gone for Nancy and Sid. Interesting, Jane, that Chris also said Nancy and Sid, because there's something about saying Sid and Nancy which can be a tad problematic,
yeah,
I think.
No, I get that. Quite a lot of opinion, should we say, about what Chris Packham had to say, and we'll look at some of your views after the news headlines here on Times Radio. Next, I should say, it's very important this, we're talking about the women in the line of fire in the protests sweeping across Iran. Before we get to that, we'll have the headlines on Times Radio from Tom Noonan.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. The Home Secretary says she has no confidence in the Chief Constable of West Midlands Police after a ban on Israeli football fans attending a game in Birmingham last year.
What is clear from this report is that on an issue of huge significance to the Jewish community in this country and to us all, we have witnessed a failure of leadership that has harmed the reputation and eroded public confidence in West Midlands Police and policing more broadly.
Shabana Mahmood says Craig Guildford needs to take responsibility for the process by which Maccabi fans were banned. He's apologised again after admitting some of the evidence used to justify that ban was generated by AI, but the Times has been told that he will resist resigning. Ms Mahmood says the government will reintroduce the power of the Home Secretary to sack chief constables, which is currently held by local police and crime commissioners. Elon Musk says his Grok AI model will comply with the laws of any country. The owner of X says he's not aware of any child sexual abuse images being produced with the tool, something the regulator Ofcom is investigating. Reuters is reporting a US official who says American personnel are being withdrawn from major bases in the Middle East after threats from Iran. Tehran says it will strike US bases in the region if Donald Trump orders military action in response to the killing of protesters. And Denmark and Greenland say they're increasing their military presence in and around Greenland. They say they're working with allies to do that ahead of talks with US officials. Don't forget, you can set the Times Radio news briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
It turns out you can please all of the people, all of the time. Garden games for the kids, a separate cottage for the grandparents, a private chef for that special occasion. Simpson Travel, idyllic Mediterranean holidays that everyone will love. We take care of the details so you can enjoy the moment. SimpsonTravel.com. Because your time is precious.
At Aberdeen Investment Trusts, we create more ways for your money to work harder. Whether you're looking to tap into global markets or target specific goals at any stage of life, we have options for you. With Aberdeen, our investment knowledge and experience become yours. Search Aberdeen Investment Trusts online to learn more. When investing, please remember that your capital is at risk.
Issued by Aberdeen Fund Managers Limited.
Something unexpected has arrived in Happy Meal. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Hello Kitty and friends are teaming up for the ultimate collab. Joining your little ones on a fun-fueled adventure. Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 2nd of February, from 11 a.m, includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last.
The day's big stories and tomorrow's front pages. Saturday and Sunday nights from 10 with Daryl Morris.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Ready to start planning your new kitchen or bathroom? If you'd like a personalised design, the Wix free design service can guide you through the whole process, including a free home measure. Book today at wix.co.uk.
Shall we share some thoughts on what Chris Packham had to say about vegan diets for dogs?
Well, I was quite sceptical going into that interview with Chris Packham, and actually the way that he explained it, if you can genuinely be giving your animals all of the nutrients that they need, but just in a different form, I don't really see what the problem is. If your dogs like it as much as the raw meat, they're eating more of it than the raw meat, what is the problem? But it's not an opinion shared by many of our listeners this afternoon.
Well, no. What does Isabel say? Re-plant-based food diet for dogs. Where's it sourced? Is it from the UK or is it imported? Costs are another factor. Can you teach an old dog new tricks for a food change? I feed my elder border terriers veggie kibble and chicken plus broth. Sounds rather lovely. I'd have that myself.
Katie says, turning off until after Chris Packham, making dogs vegan is bad for their health. Their digestive systems are designed to be omnivorous. Spreading bad advice will affect innocent animals. And Ollie queries whether it's just a vegan ultra-processed diet.
Yeah, well, that's a possibility. John Pienaar, you've got a dog, haven't you? I'm sure.
I do, yeah. My dear dog, Nelson.
Any chance that Nelson would go vegan?
Nelson likes vegetables, yeah. I mean, bizarrely, he's got quite refined tastes, Nelson. He will only eat food of reasonably good quality, and he will simply not look at food if he doesn't fancy it. You know, not like other dogs who will eat literally anything that doesn't move.
Yeah. And he'll eat vegetables.
He will gobble up broccoli. He will gobble up green beans. I suppose maybe in his sort of doggy way, he knows what his body needs at a given time.
He'll live forever. Fabulous.
Well, he's getting on.
Does he like oily fish?
Oily fish. Top of my head, I think he'll go with smoked mackerel, occasionally smoked mackerel.
He really will live forever. Okay, what have you got on your programme between 4 o'clock and 7?
Do you know what? I mean, as of this moment, I don't quite know what the shape of the show is going to be. That's because there's so much still moving. We're watching, you know, will there be an American strike into Iran? I mean, just moments ago, we got the news, this was via Reuters, the global news agency, that the Americans are pulling personnel out of their Gulf military bases, which seems to be a preparation for what would be an Iranian retaliation against an attack. But we don't quite yet know. The president has been taking advice in the Oval Office at the White House today, having announced yesterday words that seemed as if he was saying, yeah, action is imminent. Well, it's not, hasn't been imminent. It was Donald Trump. It seemed shooting from the lip. So we're trying to do some of the sort of thinking that we imagine might be taking place now in the Oval Office. I'm going to be talking to Nicholas Hopton, former British ambassador to Iran and Qatar, to Aaron David Miller, who's a former State Department negotiator on the Middle East, and to the Oxford historian Peter Frankopan. We're just going to see how that one pans out. Meanwhile, if you look up at the news screens, you'll see Greenland saying that they're going to build up their military forces on that island, presumably about trying to convince Donald Trump that he doesn't need to take over the place. But this is moving because in a very short while, leaders of Greenland and Denmark are going to be sitting down with the Vice President and with the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, and with Vance and Rubio both at the table. That could be pretty sparky. And I could mention along the way the ID cards thing, Chief Constable of the West Midlands, who is on a very, very thin thread indeed.
But apart from that, there's nothing going on. That's John Pienaar with you between 4 o'clock and 7 here on Times Radio.
It's coming up to 20 to 3. More than 2,000 people are reported to have been killed in Iran following the violent crackdown by security forces on the ongoing protests. Some of the women taking part in the demonstrations are discarding their hijabs and openly condemning the regime's leaders, acts that carry severe punishments, including imprisonment, torture and death. One widely shared video shows a woman lighting a cigarette using burning photographs of the supreme leader, the Ayatollah. Let's talk now to Nagin Shirogayan, who's an Iranian-British activist and former BBC Persia anchor. She also founded the Azadi Network, a grassroots organisation focused on amplifying marginalised groups in Iran. Nagin, it's very good to talk to you this afternoon. What are you hearing from the people you work with in Iran at the moment?
So the situation is really difficult to describe what actually is happening because of the lack of communication. So what the Iranian government has done is basically shut down the whole internet. So there is an intranet system, which is like what China does, and people can do their banking, things and that sort of like little things that you do online via that intranet system. Other than that, you cannot get access. We're lucky enough to have some Starlinks sent to Iran during Women Life Freedom and after that. But unfortunately, even with that, there's a lot of parasite. There's like communication disruption. And so the picture that I'm describing is coming from bits and pieces and people that I've managed to talk on a daily basis, like through connections and also people who are leaving the country, but some people, sources inside the country. The brutality of the crackdown was really massive. And the problem was, from day one, they had the right to kill and they were shooting to kill, even though on the first days we were see that that there's like every five police officers, and this is something that my sources in the security people, they confirmed it, that from five, one had the right to kill and a live ammunition, and the other four were using, you know, rubber bullets. Then that changed. And the numbers, 2,000 you mentioned, is going to go much higher. And that's the prediction. There's a number going around 12,000 people had died that is claimed to come from the, you know, confidential briefings within the IRGC, Iran's Revolutionary Guard, which is the force that is, you know, oppressing people inside the country. Yeah. I want to clarify one little thing that you mentioned in your intro, that the picture of the woman who's lighting her cigarette, it became a kind of movement, but it started outside Iran. So that famous picture that everyone shares and think it was inside the country, it was actually happening in Canada. But that doesn't, you know, take the light away from the bravery of the Iranian woman and how much they put their lives on the line.
Right.
And this protest is another,
Well, and again, evidence. We are always happy to clear up a mistake, and we don't want to fall into the void of either misinformation or disinformation. So thank you for making that correction. Tell us what you know, though, about the situation for women in Iran under this regime. Iran is believed to be the world's number one executioner of women per capita. Just tell us a little bit about what their crimes, and I've put that in inverted commas, are said to have been.
I'm so sorry, I lost the connection for a while. Can you repeat the question?
Sure. So I just stated a fact that Iran is believed to execute more women than any other country. And I was asking you what these crimes are meant to have been that these women are said to have committed.
So we've seen the rise of the execution of women. Some of them are drugs related and has been drugs related. And Iran is one of those countries that has the highest rate of drug related executions. But also a lot of political activists are on the line. And the Iranian government has been using this kind of vague framing of the crime to say that, you know, this person is committed a crime. And sometimes we have cases that has been documented by international community, human rights organizations, that they don't do the due process they don't have access to lawyers, there's no process of trial, and sometimes they don't even have a trial. And then a lot of the female women activists who are coming from minority groups. So we have Kurdish political activists. We have, you know, from other minority groups. They are more even on the line of executions. And that has been, or the labor activists, female labor activists, they've been the ones that the Iranian government pushed towards execution and think, oh, by creating division between the minority groups and, you know, the rest of the country, we should be able to get away with this or something. So, and then at the same time, putting more pressure on the women in the minority groups who are really brave and been on the forefront of fight against authoritarianism in the country for decades.
And again, do you believe that women will be able to take their rightful place at the table if there is regime change in Iran? I looked at the 10-point plan that is the Iran Prosperity Project this morning, and women do feature. It's just one point, though, in a 10-point plan, and it says barriers preventing women's participation in the labour market must be removed. I mean, it is very true that if women don't get a seat at the table, quite often they do not get the equality that they deserve. Are you hopeful?
So I'm really hopeful, because that plan is not what we are going for. I am in touch with a lot of feminist activists underground and the people who've been active for decades. And they are the ones who built the protest from Women Life Freedom to this one. They are the ones who are taking the, you know, on the front line of the battles. And what our strategy is not just, you know, allow them to give us one line in a 10 amendments, you know, just mention that they're going to take away the barrier. We don't want them to give us a seat on the table. We are there to build the table together. And if they agree with that, That's good for them. We're not going to wait for anyone to give us a seat. And that's the, I really believe that attitude is the attitude we want for the feminism all around the world. And it's not, it shouldn't be only for the Iranians. We have to change the dynamic of power. We should change how we are looking at power and how we are building power. And we do believe, especially in Iran, now after years of oppression, Iranian women, they're not going to back off. They're not going to let anyone else to make the decision for them. And that's why you see so much participation in the protest. And you see the Woman Life Freedom, which is the movement that is centered around this gender equality, is bringing so many different layers of the society together. Mm. Because we believe the pain of the Iranian woman is the pain of every single person in Iran. Is the intersectionality of our feminism is the uniting force for us that would bring victory for us at the end of the day.
You addressed the UN Human Rights Council in 2018 about the persecution of BBC Persian journalists and their families by Iran. You were one of the journalists targeted. What did you go through, Nagin?
I'm one of many who's been through a lot because of the Iranian government, but it's been tough. I'm not gonna downsize the pain we are going through, especially outside Iran. But I do believe the pain of the Iranian women inside needs to be more highlighted than the things we are doing. I'm gonna answer your question really quickly, but then put it on something else. But I'm living in hiding right now, right? So even outside Iran, you are not safe. So for the last year in the UK, and this is a story of a lot of other Iranian activists, especially female activists, our life is in danger. We are under transnational repression. I had to leave my house in London and live somewhere else just to make sure that I don't have to look back, you know, every second and be worried someone is trashing my house and coming in and, you know, do even worse to me. So that's one side of it. And this has been going on for more than 15 years now. But it much more intensified after Woman Life Freedom.
Yeah. We totally understand your request for us to focus on the needs of the women in Iran at the moment. But also, it is so important to note that even outside the country, you and your family have not been safe from this regime. We really appreciate you talking to us this afternoon. That is Nagin Shiragayan, an Iranian-British activist and also a former BBC Persia anchor. And she has founded the Azadi Network, which is this grassroots organisation which hopes to amplify the causes of marginalised groups in Iran.
You're listening to Times Radio. It's almost 10 to 3. And next, we're talking telly in the company of Scott Bryan. Amongst other things, we'll discuss the unexpectedly steamy ice hockey drama some people can't stop talking about. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Romantic retreats, luxury beachfront hotels, expansive family villas with sensational sea views. Not lots of, just the very best of. Simpson Travel, the magical destinations you love, the personal service you expect. We visit every one of our properties so we can handpick the perfect holiday for you. SimpsonTravel.com, because your time is precious.
Listeners, we interrupt the airwaves to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house,
and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly.
To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
Hi.
Hi, just leaving work now. Sorry it's a bit loud. Basically, so I was thinking we could get Mackey's tonight. Had a Big Mac on my mind all day, and delivery fee on the app is now from 99p. So, you in? Of course you are. Ha, love you. Bye.
Exclusively on the McDonald's app. 18 plus. Service fee and small order fee may apply. Participating restaurants. Serving times and T's and C's apply.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Scott Bryan is here to talk telly, as he does with us every single Wednesday afternoon. So,
afternoon?
Yes, hello, how are you? YouTube bigger than BBC shock. Is it really?
Not really that much of a shock. I mean, basically, what has happened in the last few years has been a massive rise of YouTube, not just in terms of people looking at videos on the internet, but also from watching them on TV. Because smart TVs, if you look on a remote control, they all have buttons now, one for Netflix, but many also have them for YouTube.
Yeah.
And I think a growing number of people have realised, why am I relying on a TV schedule of shows during the day, you know, magazine programs, food shows, property shows, when I can have very well thoughtful, in many cases, very in-depth content on YouTube that's algorithmically led. When my dad was with us, he was watching pretty much all day, every day, long-form videos about aircraft and military history. Mm-hmm. And he found it a great comfort, much more so than what he was sort of complaining about, the dreariness of daytime TV. So
right.
I think that's a massive factor. Mm. So the challenge is now, of course, if you're the BBC with limited resources, you're thinking, oh, hang on now, do we have to now also make content for YouTube as well as iPlayer and sounds? So the BBC says previously that they are. They haven't really been specific about what content they would make. I mean, I think that the Reefian values of inform, educate and entertain are certainly more vital than ever, particularly in the age of misinformation on the internet. But the main issue is, you know, firstly, the cost of it. You have to make different content than the regular content you would post on iPlayer or elsewhere. And secondly, dealing with the algorithm. You'll be competing with, you know, maybe a train spotter in Sunderland to beat your views, potentially, just because you're an established broadcaster doesn't make it any easier.
Yeah, OK. It's such a fast... I mean, couldn't the BBC make a virtue of putting some of its archive out on YouTube, or is it already there?
They certainly can. If you look at other broadcasters, ITV do, Channel 4 do. I mean, Channel 4, I mean, these commercial broadcasters, I think, aren't as ring-fenced as the BBC are. Because if you think about it, yes, you could put BBC content on YouTube, but then that could technically mean everyone else from the world could then watch BBC shows. And of course, they've not paid it through the licence fee. Mm. So that creates a big issue and headache for the BBC as well. So I'm not saying it can't be done, but it's not necessarily easy either.
But maybe if its funding model changed, it would be easier. Anyway, that's a bigger question, I guess. Let's just move on to heated rivalry, because that's what we really want to talk about. Now, this
finally.
Yes, finally, you've got your opportunity. It's about a love affair between two male ice hockey stars. Why is it causing such a sensation?
I mean, it really is causing a sensation. I think the expectation going into Christmas was that everyone was going to be talking about the final episode of Stranger Things released on Netflix. And I don't think anyone predicted it was going to be a small Canadian TV show about ice hockey that was only available initially in Canada and America, that most of the viewers have actually illegally streamed. I think from watching it, the chemistry between the two leads, Hudson Williams and Connor Story, is sensational. It's believable. I think it's also shot, you know, with a very limited budget, yes, but it really keeps your attention. I think it doesn't waste a moment. It's immediately click, love affair, and it takes you on that way. And I think it's also a show that brings you in on one thing and takes you in another. You think it's going to be sort of steamy and horny, and it definitely is. But then it then turns into and really touches on many issues surrounding, you know, being a well high performing athlete and having to deal with, you know, potentially losing marketing and money if you are out about the sexuality. To you know, I think these characters really revealing their love to each other. And at the end of episode 5, particularly, it really kind of knocks you out for 6 because it takes you off guard. I think what's not all of it is perfect per se. I think some parts of it are a little bit one-dimensional, but as a kind of a show that really kind of goes off in an expectation you didn't expect. I can see why it has become so popular so quickly.
There is a plot, is there then, for sure?
There is a plot.
Yes, I'm just checking. Now, there's a few little bits of news around today, actually, of some significance. Netflix's reported plan to switch to an all-cash offer to buy Warner Brothers and to see off Paramount. This is potentially quite interesting, isn't it?
It is. I mean, because what we've had so far, I mean, it's been very complicated, but you've had, you know, the Warner Brothers discovery, potentially, well, it is being split into two businesses. Then you've had two different offers trying to take charge of this large media company that does everything from cinema releases to live sports. And I think so far, you know, initially it was going to be Skydance, who also owned CBS, and of course got links to movie studios, were going to take an offer. What is currently Warner Brothers Discovery weren't that interested in their offer because there's been lots of reported fallings out about the people making that bid. So then Netflix swooped in and really surprised Hollywood by sort of, you know, attempting billions of amounts of money, cash, to terms of buying this, which would have really shaken up Hollywood. That's also had some detractors too. And I think essentially to fend off this rival bid, now Netflix have said, look, we'll make it all cash. So I think they're trying to use what they can to essentially put the doubters, the shareholders, from going with the other offer.
Right.
I mean, it's still not clear cut because, you know, Trump might have his own idea about this.
Oh, I'm sure he will. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he won't be backing Netflix, will he?
No. I mean, he's been quite clear. But I mean, if there's one thing we know about Trump is that he's unpredictable.
Let's also, those of us who are fans of Channel 4 News will be interested to hear that Cathy Newman is leaving. She's going to Sky News. And she's going to be up against her old show because she's going to do Sky News' 7 o'clock daily politics show. I guess she might just feel that she wasn't being used properly or used enough by Channel 4.
I mean, possibly. I mean, she's been the face of Channel 4 News now for, I think, 20 years. I think what Sky News are trying to do is poach people or make big names out of their existing talent and not just have them fronting the TV coverage during the day when linear TV viewing for news channels is generally decreasing, but trying to, you know, give them investigative podcasts, make them sort of part of the news coverage online as well. And that's what they're doing with Cathy. So maybe it's the fact that Sky News also have a great offer to give her to maybe make her the face of the channel rather than just one particular show.
Scott, always good to have you on. Thank you very much indeed. And Cathy, of course, is part of the Times Radio lineup as well. She's here on a Friday. 4 o'clock is when you'll catch Cathy Newman live here on Times Radio. On a Friday. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, well
done.
Did
I get all the facts right?
Yes, you did. Yeah, absolutely, in the right order.
Slightly fluky.
Yeah, brilliant.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Yep, she's still got it. It's 3 o'clock, still to come on our programme. President Trump has promised to help the people of Iran. We're going to unpack what that means with Brett Bruen, president of the Global Situation Room. The government is facing pressure to step up and protect jobs under threat by AI. We're going to hear more from our resident tech journalist, Christopher Walker, on that one. And today's big guest is the legendary actor, Sir Derek Jacobi, on his current tour, which he performs alongside his husband, Richard Clifford. All after the latest news headlines with Tom Noonan.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. The Home Secretary says she no longer has confidence in the Chief Constable of West Midlands Police. Craig Guildford is understood to be digging in despite apologising again to MPs after it emerged some of the evidence used to justify a ban on Israeli football fans was generated by AI. He can be sacked by the local police and crime commissioner, and the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, says she will legislate to take back that power herself.
I do, however, believe this illustrates that Home Secretaries should, in future, have this power restored to them. When a Chief Constable is responsible for a damaging failure of leadership, the public rightly expect the Home Secretary to act, and I intend to restore their ability to do so.
The Conservatives accused the Home Secretary of not acting when she heard Maccabi Tel Aviv fans were going to be banned from the game in November. Elon Musk says his Grok AI tool will comply with the laws of any country. The owner of X says he's not aware of any child sexual abuse images being generated on the site using the chatbot, despite an investigation into that by Ofcom. Keir Starmer says that will carry on.
I have been informed this morning that X is acting to ensure full compliance with UK law. If so, that is welcome, but we're not going to back down. They must act. We will take the necessary measures. We will strengthen existing laws and prepare for legislation if it needs to go further. And Ofcom will continue its independent investigation.
US officials have reportedly confirmed American troops are being withdrawn from key bases in the Middle East after threats from Iran. Politicians in Tehran are threatening airstrikes on US bases if Donald Trump follows through on proposed military action. Bitter is a human rights activist who's part of the British Iranian group Stage of Freedom. She says people protesting want the US to get involved.
What they are calling for isn't boots inside the grounds of Iran. They are simply calling for very targeted attacks on the IRGC basis so that they can continue with this organic revolution that is happening in Iran.
Danish and Greenlandic officials say there will be an increased military presence in and around Greenland from today. Negotiators are meeting US officials in Washington after Donald Trump said NATO should help him take control of the territory. Six people have been arrested as part of a fraud investigation into a social housing company. The Serious Fraud Office is looking into whether Home REIT defrauded people to the tune of £300 million. The government says vulnerable people, including rough sleepers and veterans, were promised homes by the company, which suspended trading 3 years ago. And readers of The Times and Sunday Times have raised £870,000 for three charities in its Christmas appeal. Journalists, columnists and Times radio presenters answered the phones back in December to receive your donations. That money will go to charities which help people rehabilitate after prison, one which connects young people with the elderly, and another which provides bikes to people in 28 countries. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon. Garvey and Glover here on Times Radio until 4 o'clock. We're talking tech with Chris Stoker-Walker in this hour. And our big guest after 3:30 is the incredible actor Sir Derek Jacobi. Do you know he's from Leytonstone?
Is he really? Yeah. I didn't know that. Yeah. It's a fabulous part of the east of London environment.
And he is also, and I didn't know this about him, an Oxfordian. Do you know what that means?
Well, I'm presuming that means he went to Oxford.
No, it means he believes that Shakespeare's plays were written by the Earl of Oxford.
Really?
Yeah.
Gosh, well, that is niche. Mm. Once known, never forgotten that fact,
well,
I think.
We'll discuss that a little bit later. So Derek Jacobi with us in about half an hour's time. Now, the big news of the day. Donald Trump has warned the United States will take very strong action against Iran if it goes ahead with the execution of protesters, telling Iranians, of course, you heard it here yesterday, that help is on the way.
We don't want to see what's happening in Iran happen. And, you know, if they want to have protests, that's one thing. When they start killing thousands of people and now you're telling me about hanging, we'll see how that works out for them. It's not going to work out good.
Well, the warning comes as a man of just 26, Irfan Soltani, is reportedly due to be executed today after being accused of waging war against God. Well, what does the US president mean? And by encouraging anti-government protests to continue in Iran, is he actually putting more lives at risk? Well, in a moment, we'll talk to Brett Bruen, president of the Global Situation Room and former White House Global Engagement Director under President Obama. First, let's check in with Katie Balls, Washington editor for The Times and The Sunday Times. Anything new so far today from the White House?
Not yet from the White House. What we know is Trump is threatening strong action, saying, you know, effectively, if they go ahead with the what that you're expecting, which is the execution of the figures who have taken part in the protests, then the US could step in. We're also hearing that Donald Trump and the White House have been speaking to European counterparts, which could be a sign of is there action where they need to speak to the other side? Are they working together? Is this, you know, logistics? But certainly Donald Trump wants it to be known that he has options, that he can take action. Help us coming could obviously mean different things. We already know he's taken action on tariffs, threatening those who deal with Iran with tariffs. And the question now is, how much further will he go? And I think when it comes to the case you just mentioned of that man who could be facing execution today, clearly if the Iranian regime goes ahead with this, I think it potentially becomes a flashpoint and everyone will be looking to see how Donald Trump decides to respond to that.
Yeah, so we should say it's early evening in Iran now, isn't it? They're 3.5 hours ahead of GMT. How do we know about the how will we find out about the fate of Irfan Soltani?
Well, of course, with Iran, a lot of this is just waiting to see, because we know that, you know, there are not foreign journalists on the ground. They make it very hard to report on, limited internet, and therefore, you know, for example, his family has been speaking to the press about their concerns. We could hear from the family when they hear. It's a wait and see, and that is something which the regime do on purpose.
And the American public, how strong is the support for this, well, I think increasingly interventionist president would be one way of putting it?
It's mixed. You have parts of the MAGA base who I think are obviously looking at the beginning of 2026, which they thought would be a big domestic focus ahead of the midterms in November, which are very important if the Republicans want to keep hold of the House and really the president to keep a grip of his presidency in the way he wants to do it. And they're slightly confused that the year has begun with Venezuela regime change, more threats on Greenland and now Iran. And you've had Steve Bannon, for example, the former advisor to Donald Trump, who has a big following in America and beyond, saying that, you know, no one signed up for Make Iran Great Again. This is not something where they want to get particularly involved. So, you know, but at the same time, the Ayatollah, obviously, Iran have a target on, you know, Donald Trump. They say they want him gone. So it's not as though there's much love for Iran here. The question is more, is there an appetite for the US to have another entanglement? And I'm not sure there is that, but it depends what action, you know. Short hits where the US can now get out tend to land fine if you dress it up as various things or as profitable for the US. Long walls, which are about trying to make things better for the people, tend to have less merit when it comes to the MAGA base.
If we are looking for evidence that something might be about to happen, there is a bit around today in the sense that some US personnel have left a US military base in Qatar. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, so this is the report that we've had, which they're leaving the military base. And then you also have the Iranians claiming today that calm has prevailed and things are turning in their favour. Now, of course, with the air bases, if you have a situation where people are being moved out or moved in, it could indicate a plan for action. But again, we are currently in the holding pattern and we know from past operations. So the White House in this instance is actually quite keen to almost talk up the prospect of action, which means some people in DC are more sceptical Trump will do it. They're saying, look at our recent military operations. The Iranian regime should be scared of what we can do. If you think about what, there is the rhetoric around it. But I think there is obviously an effort sometimes of Donald Trump to try and make his opponent think they're about to do something so they don't take the action. And that's why I think we're now in a wait and see as to whether the Iranian regime presses on with these executions, despite Donald Trump saying that they should not.
Thank you. Katie Balls, Washington editor for The Times and The Sunday Times. Brett Bruin can join us now, former White House Global Engagement Director under President Obama, and he now is part of the Global Situation Room. Brett Bruin, do you expect the American administration to take action soon?
I do. I think it's a question of what kind of action. Look, Trump is emboldened. He feels like the operation in Venezuela went well. However, as a former national security official, I think that can, in some ways, the past in some ways can be dangerous for precedents, because they do feel as though the risks are lessened. They're quite frankly more in a hurry, and Trump more than most to try and get on with it. And so I worry about One, you know, the speed with which we're undertaking this potential operation, you know, the U.S. military had months to the extent that they actually rebuilt the Maduro compound on that military base and practiced the operation. So, look, it may simply be we lob a few missiles over, as we did in Trump's first term, into Syria when Bashar al-Assad had crossed a red line with the use of chemical weapons. I think this case, quite frankly, is much more complicated and much more likely with the survival of the Iranian regime on the line to slip downhill quickly.
Well, the Iranian regime may well relish the opportunity to claim American interference. I mean, they might really like that because that has the potential, presumably, for bringing some of their public back on side.
Yes, and yet I think if you look at the numbers of protesters, the scale of this protest, it's very hard to make that case. And there were years of discontent, of quite frankly, widespread discontent within large swaths of the Iranian community in the country. So this is not something that you can simply write off as, you know, Trump's meddling, as Trump is instigating it. There are very real gripes. And look, not least of which, because Trump actually had pulled out of the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, which reimposed economic sanctions on the country, made life there more difficult. But, you know, the mullahs and Iran's leaders have been, you know, doing a lot on their own to increase their own lack of popularity in the country.
What might work? Something really targeted, a precise airstrike on some facilities of the IRGC. Is that possible?
Well, I think if I were sitting in the Situation Room again, what you're looking for here is the kind of action that will lead to military officers deciding that they would rather throw their lot in with the next evolution of the government rather than sticking with this one. And so, you know, I don't know that it's necessarily the kind of strike that we saw over the summer, which takes out a important capability in that case, you know, the development of a nuclear weapon. I think, you know, in some ways, it may be more of a precision strike designed to create uncertainty and instability within the ranks of the military.
Okay. And could that happen tonight, tomorrow, the day after?
Well, I think we have seen, as with the strike this summer, the strike in operation in Venezuela, that you do have indicators of a buildup. You do have some of these warnings that go out to citizens. So, yes, it may well be imminent.
Right. And it's a question of how this actually pans out and whether or not it brings about the fall of this regime and its possible replacement with something worse. Is that plausible?
Oh, well, I think you always have to account for the possibility that what comes could be worse, more extreme. Look, I think this is also where Europe and, you know, here on the continent of Europe, you saw leaders still moving quite slowly, taking quite small measures. They banned Iranian diplomats from entering EU facilities. I mean, you at this stage have to be doing a lot more.
Like what?
Well, one, I think we need to see negotiations to the end of this regime, making clear to leaders in Iran that their fate is written on the wall. And if they don't take steps to negotiate a solution, they will well find themselves either sitting alongside Nicolas Maduro in a New York jail or 6 feet underground.
And it's exactly because of what happened in Venezuela that I guess we're all expecting something to occur, and we're imagining it will be incredibly dramatic and potentially on the scale of what happened in Venezuela. I mean, is it unrealistic that America swoops in and takes the Ayatollahs or takes some of them?
Well, look, as you heard from U.S. officials, getting one person, let alone getting several, very complicated. It's the reason why Delcy Rodriguez is the interim president of Venezuela, because you couldn't go in and take multiple people and protect our people. But at the same time, the U.S. military will have developed very intensively for this, having planned scenarios. So Trump will have options on the table. I think the question right now is, what is his stated mission? And the problem, if you look at Venezuela, is the stated mission is not clear. Did we go in because of the drug trafficking? Did we go in because of the human rights abuses? Did we go in because we just wanted some oil? And so, you know, at this stage, I worry that we'll see in the days after Trump saying, well, the U.S. now controls Iranian oil, and the rest of it, you know, will be left to sort itself out by the Iranians.
I don't know whether you've got a crystal ball, but let's say it's a year from today. Who do you think will be in charge in Iran?
Well, look, ideal scenario, and this is where, again, I think Europe needs to step up. You have an international, whether it's UN peacekeeping or another body come in, help a transition, organize elections. I did this in Africa, in Liberia, in Guinea. It is what should be happening. It should be happening in Venezuela as well. But Trump clearly has disdain for the UN, for a lot of these international bodies. And yet, at the same time, you know, it's ironic. He eliminated USAID, but this is just the kind of situation, Venezuela, Iran, Ukraine, where we actually need American aid, American democracy programs to help reconstitute the country's government.
Thank you very much indeed for your time. Really interesting. Brett Bruin, president of the Global Situation Room, used to work alongside President Obama.
Right, we're going to talk about which Hollywood star is turning himself into a trademark in order to beat AI deepfakes. Just one of a host of interesting stories this week in our tech news, which we always do with Chris Stokel-Walker. We're Jane and Fee at times.radio. We are 0333 003 2353, and we should always, we always do light and shade in the afternoons. We would always like to thank people who really bothered to message us, and Chris today has sent us a whole selection of holiday photographs from a little trip that Chris is currently on in Madeira.
It does look lovely.
Which has brought some sunshine to our rather dismal grey lives at the moment. You've got sun-soaked streets, you've got green shuttered houses with that lovely pale apricot colour on the walls. Nobody is stepping in a puddle, nobody is wearing a puffer, and nobody is looking particularly glum. Stop sending them, Chris. Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Explore all the sale offers at wix.co.uk or visit your local Wix store.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
All eyes are on Iran, with the death toll in the thousands and the US poised to intervene. We'll keep you across events there. Meanwhile, could the United States make an offer to buy Greenland? The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio is meeting with the foreign ministers of Denmark and Greenland about the future of the territory. And we'll look at some of the biggest stories of the day with the columnist Yasmin Alibi-Brown and the conservative commentator Albie Amankona.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
What is it that makes a Fred Olsen cruise feel like no other? Perhaps it's the awe-inspiring destinations that will stay with you forever. Or our ships that are small in size but big in character. It could be the wonderful people you meet along the way. Or our extraordinary crew. Maybe it's all of these things together. But if you really want to know what a Fred Olsen cruise feels like, there's only one way to find out.
Listeners, we interrupt the airwaves to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house,
and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly.
To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
3, 2, 1, it's live! Go, 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 go!
We're bursting to tell you something big. Your entertainment destination has landed, and it's bursting with all your favourites.
Are you impressed by that?
A little.
Yeah, me too.
Say hello to TLC. Full to the brim with The Big Bang Theory, Young Sheldon, and brand new Georgie and Mandy's First Marriage.
What if I'm dreaming?
And just to make it even sweeter, it's completely free.
Bazinga.
TLC. Bursting with great telly.
wherever you watch free TV.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Right now, the kitchen and bathroom sale is on. There are options to suit every budget and every home. Browse all the kitchen and bathroom sale offers at wix.co.uk.
Now, we've had some breaking news in the last hour. Elon Musk says his Grok AI will refuse to produce any illegal content. It comes after this row about the AI being used to generate images of real people in underwear without their consent. The government said this week it will make it illegal to produce non-consensual sexual images with AI. We can talk about all of this and other tech stories with Chris Stokel-Walker. Chris, is this a climb down from Musk? Is this him reacting to the very real political pressure that he always seems to be able to resist, actually?
Yeah, I think it is, actually. I think that this is an indication, not necessarily that he is willing to step down in the face of pressure from the UK, but the combined pressure of multiple governments around the world. So we have seen Indonesia and Malaysia outright banning access to Grok. We have seen threats of investigations in France and Germany. And obviously, we heard the comments from both the Prime Minister and also the Technology Secretary in the House of Commons earlier this week, threatening similar sort of action and also asking Ofcom to put down its pressure on X as well. Because obviously, as the communications regulator, they are in charge of basically making sure that these platforms follow the law. And it seems like actually Musk has done a relatively quiet climb down for him. You know, this is not him grandstanding, not him making it clear about this. He is still being a little bit defiant in saying that actually he believes on a point of principle that he hasn't seen any real infringing content. But nonetheless, it does seem like they have put up those guardrails that really every other chatbot has that enables you to not create these sorts of images that can cause so much hassle and harassment to people.
Some people who are supporters of Musk, Chris, seem to want to suggest that actually what Grok AI was doing wasn't particularly difficult from things even like Photoshop. Was that ever a valid point?
Depends on how good you are at Photoshop, to be honest. But I mean, the reality is that it's the lack of friction that is required here. So Photoshop, you know, many of our listeners might know it, some of our listeners perhaps don't. An image editing tool that you can use, it does require some specialist knowledge, although it has become better and better, and more importantly, does require you to pay for that. So it's about the time and the effort that has been put into this commensurate to the impact that it can have on those potential victims. I certainly would argue that, you know, it's not the same thing, Photoshop and Grok, because Photoshop requires you to put in maybe half an hour of time working on actually editing images and fixing them so that they can cause these sorts of horrible end results. Whereas with Grok, at one point before Musk started to step in and actually put it first behind a paywall, then started to limit the access and so on and so forth, it required you to just type 5 characters into your X platform, which was at Grok, and then to basically ask for whatever you wanted, and within a match of minutes it would be produced for you effectively.
Is this a bit of a moment? You can always give us the kind of the long view and the bigger picture, actually, Chris, on these tech advancements. And is this a moment where a line of decency has actually been drawn?
In part, yes, but I would say that this is Elon Musk, and Elon Musk is perhaps only the second most inscrutable man in the world in terms of his decision making, behind the person who is potentially going to make you throw out the last half hour of your programme if he decides to do something in Iran, Donald Trump. And you know, the reality is that actually, I think this is a moment. This is, I think, a kind of standing together of Ofcom and the UK government and regulators to say, well, actually, we believe that this was beyond the pale, and Elon Musk Musk saying, well, I still believe in free expression. Both sides have kind of seemingly come to a detente in some way. What's really interesting about this, Fee, is that just yesterday I was speaking to the former head of international online safety at Ofcom, who suggested that actually he didn't think Elon Musk would step down on this. So I think what's happened, perhaps, is that he's reading the room internationally and saying, well, this isn't just the UK that is going to threaten to take action. With collaboration, we do start to see big tech coming to heel. And I think that might be a model for others to follow in the years to come.
Now, updates to your iPhone are incoming. Yay! Apple has promised improvements to its services and it's going to deliver them with the help of Google. Now, this is fascinating because I thought that Google and Apple were never to be seen in the same room together, Chris.
They're not really. Google powers the Android operating system. If you have a smartphone in your pocket, then it is probably either an Apple one or a non-Apple one. The non-Apple ones will be powered in some way by an operating system designed and maintained by Google through Android. They were eventually basically the people who came up with that operating system. And so it is strange for them to be operating in the same space here. But I think it's a recognition that Apple is being a little bit slow to the AI revolution. Previously, they rolled out this idea called Apple Intelligence, their own version of AI that was going to be built into their operating system, designed by them, was meant to be as good, if not better, than the pre-existing models like ChatGPT and Google Gemini. Turns out, I think they realised that developing that is harder than they thought, so instead they've decided to buy in Google's version of this to power Siri. So, yeah, a really significant moment in terms of these two previously opposed companies coming together.
Really significant development on our last story, we all hope. The IMF is putting pressure on the government to support workers who are being replaced by AI. Tell us more about this one.
Yeah, this is a study by the International Monetary Fund. They've been looking and warning about the impact of AI on our jobs and our livelihoods for a little while now. We might remember that we talked, I think, last year about data that suggested something like 4 in 10 jobs worldwide could be touched in one way or another by AI. Not necessarily always negatively, just means that it would have been affected in some way. And actually, it was more likely to affect white-collar jobs than blue-collar ones. We're starting to see the results of a little bit of a survey, some field work done by the IMF in 6 different countries. They've effectively looked at what impact AI has on the employment market, found that rolling out AI led to job losses in sort of jobs where actually you are vulnerable to being replaced by that. Now, the wrinkle in this is the IMF didn't say which ones those are, which is very frustrating for some of us who are worried about this. But they did say that after sort of 5 years of use, and this is counting still a little bit of the pre-ChatGPT era that came out in November 2022, employment was around about 3.5% lower in certain regions where there was a greater demand for those AI-related skills in the workforce than elsewhere. So an indication, perhaps, that something needs to be done. The IMF's Christina Grigorieva, who is the head of that, has previously said that actually governments need to think seriously about how they deal with the impact of AI on their population, because this will have a massive impact on our livelihoods in the future.
Yeah, I mean, it's a total revolution, really, isn't it, that is going to come our way, is already in progress. What's our government doing about it, Chris?
They're going full speed ahead to say effectively that AI is brilliant, and they seem to be, at least publicly in their conversations and what they're telling us, blind to the idea that actually this could displace jobs. There are some recognitions of this. There have been comments and speeches by not just Liz Kendall, but her predecessor, Peter Kyle, the technology secretary at the time, saying, well, you know, there will be some rough with the smooth coming here, but actually they seem to believe that this will empower individuals to do this, and that actually we can just all retrain. Now, yeah, I think that probably they do have something up their sleeve, at least you would hope so. But, you know, this, I think, still is a little bit of a troubling time as we start to see AI become more and more common in our lives.
Yes, and not always right. As Craig Guilford found out, a human fact checker wouldn't have gone amiss, would it, in that police force? Thank you very much indeed for talking to us. It's Chris Stokel-Walker. We chat to him at this time every week. If there's something in the tech world that you'd like explaining, Chris is your man. And you could send us an email, jane and fee@times.radio.
Yeah, he's absolutely brilliant. Our big guest this afternoon is the acclaimed acclaimed author Sir Derek Jacobi. Now, if you're my sort of vintage, you'll remember him. He was just incredible in I, Claudius on the television. Do you know, he wasn't the first choice for that role.
Who was? Angela Rippon?
No, Charlton Heston.
Charlton Heston?
He said no, but do you know who the second choice was? I mean, this is mind-boggling.
Barry from EastEnders.
Ronnie Barker.
No, you're just making it up.
No, I'm not.
No, that's AI gone wrong.
Maybe it is, but it's all on the internet. He turned it down and the role then went to Sir Derek. So he certainly did well with it. Derek Jack will be talking to us in a moment or two here on Times Radio. It's at 3:30. Here are the headlines. Tom Noonan.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. The Home Secretary says she no longer has confidence in the Chief Constable of West Midlands Police. Craig Guildford is understood to be digging in despite apologising again to MPs after it emerged a piece of evidence used to justify a ban on Israeli football fans last year was generated by AI. Shabana Mahmood says he let down the Jewish community, and the Shadow Home Secretary, Chris Philp, accused the force of a pack of lies.
West Midlands Police had evidence that Islamist extremists based in Birmingham plan to attack Maccabee Tel Aviv fans. Let's call that what it is. It is vicious anti-Semitism. And we cannot allow violent Islamists to impose their will on our country. Yet that is exactly what West Midlands Police, through weakness and through fear, allowed to happen.
The Home Secretary says she'll legislate to take back the power to sack chief constables. Elon Musk says his Grok AI model will comply with the laws of any country. The owner of X says he's not aware of any child sexual abuse images being produced by the tool, something the regulator Ofcom is investigating. Reuters is reporting a US official who says American personnel are being withdrawn from major bases in the Middle East to prepare for potential Iranian strikes. Tehran says it will strike US bases in the region if Donald Trump orders military action in response to the killing of protesters. And Denmark and Greenland says there'll be an increased military presence in and around the island. They say they're working with allies ahead of talks with US officials. Don't forget, you can set the Times Radio news briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
It turns out you can please all of the people, all of the time. Garden games for the kids, a separate cottage for the grandparents, a private chef for that special occasion. Simpson Travel, idyllic Mediterranean holidays that everyone will love. We take care of the details so you can enjoy the moment. SimpsonTravel.com. Because your time is precious.
Chase is the digital bank you can count on.
How so?
Because you get 1% cash back on your grocery shop.
Like on prosciutto?
Yeah, prosciutto.
And seaweed crackers?
Sure, those two.
Oh, hang on, what about rotisserie chickens?
If it's in your grocery shop, Chase has got your cash back. Join today and get 1% cash back on debit card spending on groceries, fuel and everyday transport. Chase, see what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents eligibility applies. 1% cash back for your first year. Maximum £15 per month. Exceptions apply.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Get ahead of the news with Kate Borsay from 7pm as she brings you Tomorrow's Times Today. An exclusive look at the stories making tomorrow's headlines.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. The kitchen sale is now on. Start 2026 with a brand new kitchen. Kitchens start from under £3,000. Explore all the sale offers at wix.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wix store.
Good afternoon to you. 25 minutes to 4 o'clock, Times Radio, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover until 4. John Peanut takes over then. It's going to be a busy old evening. I think we can probably assume that. And John will be your guide, certainly between 4 and 7. Let's turn to our big guest today, Sir Derek Jacobi, one of Britain's greatest actors. He's currently on tour in what's being described as an in-conversation show featuring his husband, Richard Clifford, who's an actor and a producer in his own right. Sir Derek, Richard, hello. Good afternoon. How are you both?
Good afternoon to
Hello.
You.
Hello. Very well.
Lovely, lovely to hear. Now, can we start with your illustrious career, Sir Derek, if you don't mind? I have just read a review of the show you did with Richard in Perth, and they loved it there. The reviewer said, if Sir Derek had tagged on another half hour, I wouldn't have batted an eyelid. It was an incisive and captivating insight into an icon of stage and screen. Well, that suggests you're both getting something right. Do you remember Perth? Was it a particularly good night?
Yes, and I think I wrote that.
Did you? Yes. So what form does the show take, Derek?
Question and answer, basically. You know, I'm quizzed about my life in art.
By your husband, crucially.
And as much as I can remember, I spout.
Right. Is he a particularly sensitive and incisive interviewer?
Yeah, he's very good. He's very good, yes. And that is essential because I'm neither incisive nor sensitive.
Okay, that's also reassuring. Richard, do you find it in any way awkward to be interviewing Derek, or do you feel that you can ask him anything?
We have been together now for 47 years.
Yes.
So I feel that I sort of know the ins and outs. I mean, I ask him a question and he gives a nasty turn. And then he might say something and I will say to him, I don't remember that. Occasionally, we get some rather wonderful, not secrets, but things that we've never discussed before. So
yeah, and I tend to make things up.
Oh, great. Okay, that's my kind of show. Might I suggest that you might occasionally drop a name or two, Derek?
Oh, I've got buckets of them.
Who are they? Who do you talk about?
Oh, Sir Laurence Olivier, Maggie Smith, Albert Finney. These are all the people I was at the National with.
Ian McKellen. Judy Dench. Joan Plowright.
They're all there.
Right. I mean, it does sound as though people who go along will get their money's worth. When you look at Wikipedia, as I'm sure you both do incessantly, it's very hard to pick a career highlight of yours, Derek. I mean, yes, there's I, Claudius, which a lot of people remember, of course. Gladiator, you're in both the films. So many people, and I'm one of them, loved Last Tango in Halifax. And you narrate in The Night Garden. What do you pick? What is your career highlight?
When I played Hamlet at the Edinburgh Festival as a schoolboy.
Yeah, and how did that happen?
Through our English master, Bobby Brown, and he got us up to the festival on the fringe of the Edinburgh Festival. And I was, 17? And play Hamlet up there and all the notable people, whom at the time I didn't realise, came to see it. And so when I left school and university and I went begging for jobs, I got replies because people had seen me playing Hamlet at Edinburgh.
I mean, it does seem quite remarkable. This man was clearly an exceptional teacher.
Bobby was extraordinary. He was an English teacher. He was a great fan of the theatre. He produced the school plays. And he really was my conduit from school to university to the business.
So, I mean, I had imagined, I must admit in my ignorance, that you'd grown up in rather sort of highfalutin circumstances, but you hadn't. You're from Leytonstone. Just tell us a little bit about your family and your childhood.
I'm sure there are certain highfalutin areas of Leytonstone.
Oh, yes, no, there are. People will be looking on Rightmove as we speak.
I wasn't part of that, no. my family worked in the Walthamstow High Street, both mum and dad. And my background was very ordinary. I went to the local primary school. I went to the local grammar school, and then I got into the what was it called? Wait, so long ago now. The pool. I got into the pool when I was sitting the examination for university.
Right.
So I had an interview at Cambridge. And they accepted me, and I spent 3 years at St. John's College, Cambridge, and acted all the time. I studied history. They tell me I studied history.
Did you get a degree?
I did. I got what was called a 2-2.
Yes, well, you're in good company.
Straight down the middle.
Right, OK, excellent. And, I mean, your parents, were they bewildered by your talent? Did they relish it?
They loved it. They encouraged it. I don't think they totally understood it. I mean, they would gently fight over where I got it from, whether it was my father or my mother.
Well, who do you think you got it from, or is it just one of those things?
I was just born. I came out acting, and that was it. They had to take it on board, which they did. They were the most supportive, wonderful parents anyone could ever have wished to have.
Oh, that's lovely, because you don't always hear that. I mean, I did read that your dad ran a sweet shop. I mean, is there anything more wonderful than growing up as the child of a sweet shop proprietor? Was that true?
He did indeed, in Chingford. Yes, and I used to go up to see him up there, of course, and help myself to some of the sweets. And as soon as a customer would come in, I'd sort of duck behind the counter and call out, "Dad, you've got a customer," because I was terrified of having to serve and all that. But I loved going to see him up there, yes, because I had the run of the shop.
Yeah, you were allowed to stick your hand in the humbugs?
Oh, you bet. I wouldn't have gone otherwise.
No. I'm just thinking of some of the great sweets of my childhood. Mm. Those bright yellow sherbet balls. I mean, they were just fantastic. What were they called? Lemon bonbons. Did your dad sell them?
Yes, and I ate things on sticks.
Drumsticks.
That you could suck. Forever.
Yes. Yeah, it was a wonderful world. If anyone's slightly younger than any of us listening, you've missed out. It was great back then. It really was. What was Cambridge like? I mean, because the footlights, I always assume everybody was in the footlights. Were you?
No, I wasn't in the footlights. The footlights was comedy. Most of it stand-up comedy and sketches and things. And no, I wasn't in footlights. I was in the ADC, the Amateur Dramatic Club, and I was in the the company at the Arts Theatre, the Marlowe Company. That was by invitation. If you were seen in companies, student companies in and around Cambridge, the Marlowe came knocking at some point, hopefully, and invited you to be in one of the big Marlowe productions.
So it doesn't sound, from what you've been saying, that you struggled as an actor. Your talent was obvious fairly early on, and you started getting roles, straight from university?
You're talking to the luckiest actor ever.
Well, you're not without talent.
Well, hopefully, no. I fulfilled the opportunities I was given. But it's those opportunities that are so vital. You can be the most talented actor in the world, but if no one asks you to act, it's a bit wasted. But I was asked on several occasions, and some of them were important occasions. And luck was with me.
Richard, is Derek as humble as he sounds?
Yes, he is. I hate to disappoint.
Right, I was just checking. Because sometimes...
humble and boring.
Oh, I never stop talking. He absolutely is. He has credited his chances in life to luck. You know, some people have to... constantly seeking things out. Derek happened. Sir Laurence Olivier went to see him in a play at Birmingham and invited him to join Chichester Theatre, which then became the first National Theatre of Great Britain.
Yeah,
well, it's all the way. 5 years. Yeah.
We've got some messages for you. Victoria says Derek Jacobi is superb in I, Claudius, and hundreds of other things. Although Victoria draws our attention to the fact that Ronnie Barker was a good straight actor. He was brilliant as Churchill's butler in The Gathering Storm. Yes, I just couldn't believe that Ronnie Barker was second in line to get the I, Claudius role, and you were third, Derek. That's unbelievable.
Yes, Ronnie Barker was second. First was Charlton Heston.
Charlton. He felt he could say no to the BBC.
Yes. And so did the other one. So I'd done a BBC series called Man of Straw with a wonderful director called Herbie Wise, who was down to direct I, Claudius. And Herbie said, "What about Derek?" And I said, "Derek who?" And Herbie explained about Man of Straw, and they said, "Well, let's talk to him." And they did, and thank God, whatever I said got me passed. And they said, "Okay, I think they phrased it, we'll take a chance."
Were you worried?
I am constantly.
Well, I think you should probably stop worrying now, because I think you've stated your claim. You've been knighted, for heaven's sake. Steve says, Derek's performance in Last Tango in Halifax was sublime. I know he's done a load more than this, but that portrayal of Alan Buttershaw had me laughing and crying in equal measure. Please, sir, is there any chance of more tangoing? That's from Steve, who's a gardener in Maidenhead.
Oh, I love Last Tango. It came out truly out of left field with the wonderful Annie.
Yeah.
And it was just magic. And the two of us, we didn't know each other before it, and we just clicked. We adored each other, trusted each other, and it was magic to do. The texts were wonderful. The stories were good. The relationship worked, and and we got paid.
Yes, yeah, that's true. Jacqueline says that when you did the jive in Last Tango in Halifax with Anne Reid, it was just incredible. So many people, so many fond memories of that programme. I think we've established there can't be any more, can there?
No, I'm too old to jive.
Okay, you won't be jiving. Can we talk Shakespeare? Because I think you've played Hamlet. Well, you tell me, how many times have you given us your Hamlet?
It's hundreds.
500.
It's hundreds, including, I'm very proud and pleased to say, at Elsinore.
Now, yes, just explain the significance of that.
Well, Elsinore is in Denmark. It's where the play of Hamlet is set by Mr. Shakespeare or whoever. And it is the most magical place, and we played in the courtyard of the castle, and it was magic. Yes, it was extraordinary to be Hamlet talking about Elsinore and actually be there, and we had the ghost walking along the ramparts of the castle. It was magical.
Wow.
It was
lovely. That's incredible. So yeah. Evocative. I imagine you have seen Hamlet, or can you tell me, have you both seen it?
Oh, Hamlet.
Yes, I saw it last week.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. What's your verdict?
Wonderful. Wonderful.
It's lovely. And I have to say, Jesse Buckley, who we both work with a couple of times, is a joy. And Derek's worked with Paul Mescal, who's also a joy.
Yeah. It
looks beautiful. It's a stunning story about a couple whose desperate loss of a child really affects us all. It's the everyman of child grief, really.
Yes. Do go and see it. It's magic. Magic.
Right. Okay, well, that's unequivocal. But, of course, Derek, I believe that you don't think that this man, William Shakespeare, wrote these plays anyway.
No, I don't, no.
Well, who did?
Earl of Oxford.
Right. And this puts you in the Oxfordian category.
It puts me in the madhouse, actually.
Well, I was going to say, is it a minority view?
I think it must be. I think it must be, yes.
Well, why do you believe it so strongly?
Because I cannot believe very, very strongly that the man from Stratford had the ability, the education, the knowledge to have had anything to do with writing those plays. And I think Oxford had all the qualifications necessary. I'm not saying that that is absolute proof, but if we're talking about the ability and the qualifications of either of those candidates, then you have to go for Oxford.
Richard, what do you think?
Well, I'm afraid I agree. I happen to be chairman of the De Beer Society. The reason I feel it is the case is because every direction takes us towards someone who had immense knowledge, not only of theatre, of Greek, of Latin, of the law, of French, of Italian, knew Italy very incredibly well. And it's something that you could not just get out of books or, quite frankly, listening to sailors at the Mermaid Tavern. Mm. You would need a whole lot more. And I could go on for hours, but I'm not going to, because people just poo-poo it and say, how dare you, and you're being snobbish. But I'm not being snobbish. It just happens to be what I think. And it would be wonderful if we actually found out, the more we find out, author write.
Oh, no, we haven't lost them, have we?
The play,
oh,
the canon.
Right.
Is where in the canon is the man from Stratford?
Well, I tell you who won't be pleased, and that's the tourist office in Stratford-upon-Avon, as they hear this. In 100 years' time, are we going to be talking about the Royal De Vere Company? And will it be based in Oxford? I don't know where De Vere was from, the Earl of Oxford. I'm going to suggest Oxford.
It would be nice. It would be nearer the truth than the Stratford connection.
I must admit, I didn't realise that you felt as strongly, or that so many people feel as strongly about this. I did a tiny bit of research, and there do appear to be quite a number of people who think you're both right.
I think we're, what did they say, kicking against the pricks or something?
Right.
Pressing against.
Something like that.
Against an open door?
It's a hiding to nothing.
It is, but people emotionally are attached to, they use the word belief all the time. And when you say, I believe, credo doesn't mean it is right. It just means believe it to be right.
Yeah, okay. I know, Derek, have you given up theatre completely? I know this In Conversation event, they're happening in theatre.
Yes, I have.
So
you'll
never tread the boards again in a play?
I wouldn't say that, because there are methods these days, methods that I have used. But with television, film, with the omnipresence of cameras, I would rather go down that route than the pressure of going onto a stage. It ain't easy.
And
eight times a week, acting twice on Thursdays and Saturdays. It ain't easy, stage acting. It's bloody hard. It really is. And I adored it for so many years. But there comes a time when you can't give the audience what they deserve. So stop it. Give it up. It was wonderful. It gave you a life and a world that is indescribable. Mm. But there came a time when I had to let go. It wasn't easy. My goodness, I didn't want to let go. But you have to when you can't do it anymore.
Did you say that you two had been together for 47 years?
Yep.
We have.
What's the secret? Because actors having relationships with actors doesn't always work, does it?
When couples are asked that, they always say, give and take.
Give us the truth. No, my give and take. Give us the truth.
I tell you,
give, he takes.
One thing is that we worked away from each other. What we have done, which is a little secret, is we have spoken to each other every day.
Yeah.
Over 47 years.
We are.
Unless we're actually in the air and we can't get to a phone.
Or in prison.
Well, I don't think. Well, you've yet to be arrested, Sir Derek, and let's hope it stays that way.
We did make a film in prison, though. So
yes, we have filmed in prison.
Yeah,
yes.
In Polsmoor in Cape Town. So
right. Oh gosh. Okay. I think people will have had a flavour from that conversation, and I suspect they'll be dashing off to get tickets because that just sounds fascinating. An in conversation evening, Richard Clifford and Sir Derek Jacobi, and you can have a look online. There are dates coming up over the next couple of months all over the country. It's Times Radio, and it's four and a half minutes. Get it right to four.
Chloe Tilley and Callum MacDonald on Times Radio Breakfast with Visit Scotland. Discover Times Radio's essential weekend briefing, where intelligent conversation meets incisive analysis of all the big stories making the headlines. Exploring the wider news agenda with guests from across politics, business, the arts and more. Chloe Tilley and Callum MacDonald on Times Radio Breakfast. Saturday and Sunday mornings from 6 with Visit Scotland. Start your story in Scotland with visitscotland.com/winter.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
At Aberdeen Investment Trusts, we create more ways for your money to work harder. Whether you're looking to tap into global markets or target specific goals at any stage of life, we have options for you. With Aberdeen, our investment knowledge and experience become yours. Search Aberdeen Investment Trusts online to learn more. When investing, please remember that your capital is at risk.
Issued by Aberdeen Fund Managers Limited.
Romantic retreats, luxury beachfront hotels, expansive family villas with sensational sea views. Not lots of, just the very best of. Simpson Travel, the magical destinations you love, the personal service you expect. We visit every one of our properties so we can handpick the perfect holiday for you. SimpsonTravel.com, because your time is precious.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Yes, a lot of people just want to know more about the Earl of Oxford and this theory. And I honestly didn't know. I knew that there were some suspicious chat about who Shakespeare might have been and how on earth could this former glove maker from a relatively obscure place suddenly come up with these works of genius.
Don't underestimate a glover.
No. Oh, God, what have I done there? this show is so carefully produced. It's just unbelievable. But I didn't realise people took it all so seriously.
Oh, I bet they do, Jane.
Yeah. No, I guess they probably do. So Derek and Richard are on tour, and you can find the dates. I think the next one coming up is actually in Cambridge, which, of course, is his alma mater, so there'll be plenty of people there. Educated folk, I would imagine, going to a gig in Cambridge.
I love it when you just slip into Latin. I think it should happen more often. I also loved their answer about, what makes a relationship tick, because we're all fascinated by other people's relationships. And the honest answer of we're away a lot, I think, is probably quite really reassuring helps to many people.
Yeah, as a novice reporter in local radio, I used to get sent to interview a lot of people celebrating their 65th or 70th wedding anniversary.
But were they celebrating?
Well, no, they weren't. They usually looked daggers at each other and would claim that the secret was never go to bed on a row. And you think, no, this is just nonsense. They just thought it was better to stay together because they didn't see too much out there. Anyway, there you go. That's a philosophical note on which to end. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking, she says carefully, to the director of the new documentary that's out now. And I saw it last night. It's very interesting. Becoming Victoria Wood. So that's tomorrow on the programme. Who do we want to thank today?
We want to thank our producer today, who is Hannah Quinn. Our technical operator was, and we hope always will be, Ryan Boyden. Up next, it's John Peanut with Drive with a very busy evening. Stay with Times Radio if you can.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane, at 4 o'clock. I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. There are reports that US troops are being withdrawn from key bases in the Middle East after threats from Iran. The Home Secretary says she no longer has confidence in the Chief Constable of the West Midlands Police. And coming up, are we about to see US military intervention in Iran? And if so, how might that play out? I'm going to be talking to a range of experts about what is coming up. And from one international strain to another, we'll see what comes of the White House meeting about the future of Greenland between the US, Denmark and Greenland. And we're going to be looking at the government plan for a new power to dismiss police chiefs. This is after the row over the Maccabi fan ban.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Tom Noonan.
Good afternoon, John. Thank you. The Home Secretary says she has no confidence in the Chief Constable of West Midlands Police after a ban on Israeli football fans attending a game in Birmingham last year.
What is clear from this report is that on an issue of huge significance to the Jewish community in this country and to us all, we have witnessed a failure of leadership that has harmed the reputation and eroded public confidence in West Midlands Police and policing more broadly.
Shabana Mahmood says Craig Guildford needs to take responsibility for the process by which Maccabi fans were banned. He's apologised again to MPs after admitting a piece of evidence used to justify that ban was generated by AI, something he assured MPs had not happened. The Times has been told he will resist resigning, though. The Conservative Shadow Home Secretary, Chris Philp, says Ms Mahmood has questions to answer herself.
She expressed concerns and took action only after the decision became public on October the 16th. By when it was too late. She was asleep at the wheel at the critical time.
Shabana Mahmood says the government will reintroduce the power of the Home Secretary to sack chief constables, which currently rests with local police and crime commissioners. US forces are reportedly pulling out of a number of bases in the Middle East amid the threat of Iranian airstrikes. Tehran's promised to attack if the US launches military action in response to the killing of protesters. Bitter, a human rights activist who is part of the British-Iranian group Stage of Freedom, says those demonstrating want Donald Trump to act.
What we are seeing factually come out of Iran is, you know, people taking to their social medias, recording videos of themselves, very clearly calling for the help of President Donald Trump. And we've even seen individuals name a street in Iran after Donald Trump, where they literally printed out a label and had plastered it over the name of that particular street, calling it Donald Trump Street.
Elon Musk says his AI model, Grok, will not produce any illegal images and will comply with the laws of any country. The owner of X says he's not aware of any child sexual abuse images being produced using the tool, something the regulator Ofcom is investigating. The Prime Minister says he's been given assurances the site will comply with British law. Danish and Greenlandic officials say there'll be an increased military presence in and around the island from today. Negotiators are meeting US officials, including the Vice President J.D. Vance in Washington, after Donald Trump said NATO should help him take control of the territory. The family behind Russell and Bromley are thought to be split over whether to sell the company to Next or to a private equity company. Auralis has produced a deal which would save all of the footwear brand's jobs, its head office and the distribution centre and most of its shops. The proposal by Next is expected to close all of the stores and put most of the jobs at risk. And David Hockney's accused the British Museum of vanity and recklessness over its plan to move the Bayeux Tapestry this summer. The 88-year-old says it's madness and the museum is gambling on the 1,000-year-old tapestry surviving the journey. The museum says it will test how it will transport the art with a copy of the tapestry first. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. We are watching and we are waiting. Wait with us. Tragically, it seems nothing can save the poor Iranian protester from the Ayatollah hangman. No mercy, certainly no intervention. And now it turns out that when President Trump told the Iranian protesters being gunned down in their thousands, help is on its way, He was shooting from the lip. His Truth Social post yesterday, "Keep protesting, take over your institutions," sounded almost like an announcement that the bombers and the missiles were already heading towards Iran. Well, they weren't, and it wasn't. It was a declaration that the United States wanted regime change in Iran. Later, we learned the president hadn't decided what action he meant to take to bring regime change about. That may have changed. Just before we came on air, the global news agency Reuters reported that some US personnel are being pulled out of bases in the Middle East. It looks like a precaution against Iranian retaliation to an American strike. Today we're witnessing a hugely important moment in real time. The meetings in the Oval Office of the White House must surely be fraught. The military advice, the political wrangling to get and keep the president's attention. If it's not tense, well, it ought to be. So on today's programme, we'll try to do and share the thinking you'd imagine must be taking place in the Oval Office. What are the options for US action? If it's a bomb or a missile strike, what or who will be the target? Are we looking at a cyber attack? And crucially, what are the chances of any attack achieving the removal of the murderous hardline Islamist regime? Well, no one knows, because no one can, what might come next when and if the regime falls. In a moment, the most expert and informed analysis of what may be coming and what may and importantly may not happen next. You know, sometimes "I don't know" is the best answer available. And the answer that's most often ducked, well, I can promise we are going to be clear about what we know and what we can't know while we all wait together. Tell me what you're thinking. Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or tweet to @TimesRadio. First, let's just go back on those reports that military personnel from US air bases in Qatar have been told to leave. It's just added to the speculation that President Trump may order military intervention in Iran at some point soon. President Trump, speaking outside Air Force One last night, responded to claims that Iran would retaliate if attacked by America.
Yeah, Iran said that the last time I blew them up with the nuclear capability, that which they don't have any longer. So Iran said that the last time. They better behave.
Now then, that's President Trump. Let's get the thoughts of Aaron David Miller, a former Middle East peace negotiator at the State Department. Hi to you, Aaron.
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm well, and it's good to have you
with us. Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you. Aaron, it's great to have you with us at a time like this. I mean, do tell me, if you were advising the president today, is there a form of military action that you believe might be valuable in helping the cause of freedom and human rights in Iran?
Look, when it comes to Iran, John, whether it's diplomacy, military strikes, clandestine activity, cyber, there are no good options here. And I think the last period from December 28th until now suggests that there's absolutely no evidence that the regime is fracturing, that the security personnel, including the military that besieged the IRGC, which numbers close to a million, are prepared to do anything they can in order to crush these protests. Mm. But the real question, I think, is not what the options are for the president. I mean, they run the gamut from the sort of rhetorical support he's provided to ramping up radio broadcasts, although hollowing out VOA, Voice of America, has not served American interests, to seizing ghost ships, Iranian tankers, to acting against economic targets, Kharg Island or Iranian oil infrastructure,